This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Giovanni Donato. Giovanni, it's great having you back on the show.
All right, thank you.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Giovanni.
Nice to meet you.
Since the last time we talked, has there been any particular theme that you've been focusing on?
I think lately I've been focusing a lot on the aesthetics of culture. You asked me in particular about the development of a post-Western aesthetic. In other words, what I think will come after an age of the modern West as we know it, as it becomes unsustainable, both culturally, philosophically, as well as resources.
And in this article, what a post-Western aesthetic might look like, you post a lot of references to the film Dune.
To the book Dune, anyhow. I grew up with the book Dune, and those were the images in my head. The movies, either the film or the miniseries, they have their strengths, but it was always images from that book that were in my mind. It's a dense material that movies have difficulty with.
And then a lot of these images, some of them are of ancient cities in the Middle East, and I think one of them is like of a Mongolian yurt.
Yeah, that's what that would be. Yeah, I just like the style of a house that does what it's supposed to be. It's not a 4,000 square foot McMansion, and it's cozy and comfortable. It feels like home. I think what a future economy would be more about is getting the job done and less about showing off.
But I see a picture of a Riven in the Skype chat. What is that picture? What is that significance of?
I always liked the look, you know, as an adolescent growing up playing the Myst games. Partly because the buildings and the artwork was gorgeous. Also because the people who in this fictional universe build these things use what's locally available in very sophisticated ways to do things our technology couldn't do.
You know,
I always thought the idea that was really cool.
I'm actually a fan of Myst too. I know the whole Dunny background too. Yeah. I was into this too. I never beat Riven. I just had a cheat through it, and I was just surprised. Like, it's one of those games where if you know it, it seems so obvious. But in a previous episode, we talked about architecture design, and I actually referenced Myst and some of that.
Oh, was this the one you were referring to, that shopping center in LA I took a photo of?
Yes. The dome reminded me of something out of Riven. I think it was the Genza lab where he produced things, and I was being very technical with that. I mean, you have to grow up with these games to understand it. I played most of the Myst games. I think my favorite one was actually number 3. But
I played the third one because it was Exile. No, Riven was Exile.
Yeah, Exile was 3. That was by a different company.
No, the third one is the one that had Brad Dorf as the bad guy, you know, Grima Wormtongue.
Yes. I had that for Xbox and the computer, and I found that the most easily accessible one. Oh, yeah, that's the picture, Robert, the exact one.
Or you mentioned Dune. He's the Mentat, the evil.
Yeah, there's another in Dune, and you make this very of a esoteric thing in the background.
That picture I took, it's of this mall, but it's interesting as you go up to this place, and you're on top of this parking structure. It's like this sort of, it feels like this kind of abandoned old structure. What's the word? Kind of like ruin, almost like ruin, the kind of ruin porn genre.
Like condemned or derelict?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a YouTube series. I think it's called Abandoned, and they talked about like abandoned Circuit Cities and abandoned, you know, some other stores, and they walk through these abandoned places, you know, places where young kids will do graffiti, skateboard, have sex, do drugs in those places. I don't know. Typical cliche things you think young people
do. It sounds like you're describing a great deal of the Rust Belt.
Yes.
Did you grow up in the Rust Belt?
I actually grew up in the desert Southwest.
There was this plan in Arizona by this Italian architect, Paolo Saleri, called Arcansanti, and it was this kind of proposed town that would be made. It would be like a self-contained city built out in the middle of the desert, and it does remind me a lot of what you're talking about.
I had a look at it at your recommendation, just a Wikipedia article and some pictures. It has a cool look to it. It has like a warm Mediterranean, almost like a terracotta feel to it. And as you say, kind of blends in with the landscape. Looks pretty cool.
And then there's this concept called arcology. And I think basically the definition of arcology is having a form of human habitation that's within one self-sustained structure as opposed to like multiple dwellings.
Yeah, I included in my aesthetic some Antarctic bases. I think that closed-in look looks cool when it's like in a really hostile environment where that kind of approach is required.
It's kind of interesting how futurism and the ancient world kind of overlap, because a lot of these ancient Middle Eastern cities and cities throughout the world were like that. I mean, there was a scarcity of resources, and also because there was a kind of threat of invasions by other tribes, so people were forced to kind of condense, or even you could even kind of make a comparison to these kind of medieval fortresses. And I think we'll see that trend in the future, because the current model of the single-family home and the automobile, I mean, that's not sustainable. So I think you definitely will see this trend in the future.
Yeah, we will see a gradual phasing out of the completely atomized individualistic society. And as far as like Mesopotamian states, I mean, they were city-states where everyone, rich or poor, was in the same boat. If the city was sacked, that was the end of the nation and probably their lives.
And today, yeah, I mean, today people are so divided. We have the rich live in certain cities, these like the so-called coastal elite, and then the working class in the Rust Belt and the Midwest and the South. And there's so much geographic division. With these kind of things, I mean, do you see them on a smaller scale, or could you see like one being a like decent sized city of maybe a quarter of a million and like one self-sustained structure?
Are you talking about regional separations within the United States?
Yeah, I was talking about kind of the regional separations, and then I mentioned like with self-contained cities.
I would see self-contained cities as something implemented where it's truly necessary, like in a wasteland. As far as political separation, I think that'll be a lot different and more complicated than it was in, say, the 19th century. Because look at how people now live basically a semi-nomadic lifestyle, moving from city to city. And there's no one really assumes anymore you necessarily live or base your life in your hometown.
You mentioned when you were in Korea, you actually lived in this sort of self-contained city. What was that like?
So by self-contained, do you mean environmentally or economically? Because this, I was in a exurb of Seoul, about 45 minutes outside of it. And what impressed me about it is it was 500,000 people in like a 3 by 3 mile square. And it didn't feel cramped. There were green spaces. And they managed it by having people live in high-rise buildings. All the high-rise buildings were spaced with an easy walking distance of shops. And in between the buildings, they would have open squares where I'd see the locals drying out red chilies. You know, it was the fall season around Chuseok. And I was amazed at what they could do with that space. And it felt so much better than an American sprawled topolis.
The thing about living in a place like that is you have all your amenities within walking distance. In American society, I mean, just you have to drive everywhere. And I think there's this kind of notion that I hear a lot from conservatives and traditionalists, that you need to have like single family homes in order to have a community. And they'll say that compact living destroys a sense of community or identity. But it really depends, I mean, how it's done. Obviously, in major American cities today like New York, I mean, you're not going to have that strong sense of community. Now, when you were living in Seoul, did you sense there was a strong sense of community there?
Yeah, I mean, outside of Seoul and in Seoul, I got the... I mean, you can't help but get this sense from Koreans that they're almost like a big family. I mean, you just notice with a lot of those Asian cultures, they tend to have one word that means you're an outside person. There's them, and then there's everybody else. But the way they use land was really intriguing. Like where they'd have green space, I would see them using like strips of land by railroad tracks to grow sorghum and corn. It was really interesting.
You just think about all the waste and our society. I drive for any suburb and you see these massive parking lots in front of all the stores. I mean, especially like a Walmart, but even the smaller stores, and it completely ruins a place.
Well, with America, we have to consider that people take advantage of cheap, abundant land. Also, I think the American trend of suburbanization is because Americans are not homogenous. It's a vast empire with people of every creed and ethnicity you can imagine. Like even white Americans come from 100 different ethnic groups. So I think that's one of the causes of extreme American atomization. People are fleeing each other.
Yeah, I think those are the two factors. The merit that America is a relatively new country, the rise of the automobile, but that, yeah, that's also the other factor. That's always been this tradition. One group comes in, then the other group moves to the suburbs, and then that trend keeps going as another group comes in. Then the new immigrants that come in, they want to move to the suburbs, so that pushes like suburban sprawl even further. I think if you had a more cohesive society, people would be more comfortable living in these compact, self-sustained communities.
If they had a sense of shared purpose, like even it's not even just the space, it's about the services people rely on as well. Like perhaps the biggest example is the euphemistic, in air quotes, good school districts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it just means white if you say it's good.
Yeah, white and the model minorities.
Yeah. Model minorities. That sounds a lot like Asians and whites together, while they're everyone else, like blacks, Mexicans, Indians, what have you, they're just put to the side, and only whites and Asians can really be, I guess, harmonious together, or at least do something.
Or so goes the rhetoric. Well, I find with Asians, it makes a huge difference how long they've been in the country. Generation Asians have attitudes that are quite distinct from Western culture.
You wrote an article about Singapore a while back, and you looked it over recently, and there's some interesting observations because, I mean, Singapore is a country that's kind of been described as quasi-fascist, but there are different misconceptions about Singapore. I think one of them is that Singapore, it's always been conservative and libertarian economists give Singapore as an example of the success of the free market. But there was a lot of status engineering involved in setting up that country. I think the founder of Singapore, he was actually even influenced by Sir Oswald Mosley. You could kind of describe Singapore as this kind of futurist quasi-fascist state.
What led me to look on Singapore as a template is that it is a multi-ethnic, multicultural society that also has to cope with extremely high population density.
People have said that Singapore is a successful example of a multi-ethnic society. But, Singapore is about 70% Chinese, and the rest mostly Malay and Indian. So you do have one sort of dominant group that binds the other groups together.
That certainly helps them.
And that they speak somewhat like English is kind of a thing.
Though I think it is a bit more complicated than that, because there used to be a lot more, I mean, on some research I did before this, it seems like the Malay culture has a disparate impact because there used to be more of them. And I looked at the Lee Kuan Yew guy that founded the modern state, and he's like a mix of two different Chinese minorities, not Han Chinese. And I understand that the Southeast Asian Chinese are kind of a breed in their own right.
Oh, he's from the Hakka group. They're a kind of group that's been known for being a successful mercantile diaspora.
Yeah, like those diaspora Chinese are sort of like a mercantile class of Southeast Asia. It's interesting.
There's also, I think it was at the Sarong Party Girl, basically the Asian woman that goes after white men or something in Singapore, where basically if Western men go over there, they're going to have a high chance of finding an exotic foreign beauty to, you know, flirt, be with. I guess that, you know, I always think that women as capital are usually an important method of getting people towards interesting, you know, to the country, right? If there's like no pretty women in certain countries, then less men are going to obtain there, you know?
Yeah. It helps to stand out as an exotic foreigner. And I think it would also help that Singapore was a former British colony, so people are likely to at least have some English.
Yeah, and Lee was raised in British schools. So he was, and as I said earlier, I think he was influenced by Sir Oswald Mosley. There was actually a eugenics plan in Singapore where basically what happened is...
Oh, really?
I was reading this somewhere, the underclass, if they had more than two kids, the woman was sterilized, and then he was concerned that like college-educated women were not having enough kids, so there were state-sponsored subsidies to have more children for college-educated women. So, that's basically was a eugenics program. I think that was back in maybe the 50s or 60s.
Yeah, this guy definitely tried a lot of policies that may become relevant to larger multicultural countries in the long run.
But as I was saying earlier, there is this perception that Singapore is hyper-capitalistic. You mentioned in your article there is some degree of socialism, and there's also public housing.
Yeah, from what I understand, they have a decent medical system, good public services, and I think they stay as functional as they do because of their authoritarian element. When you don't have a homogenous people that are all on the same page, like for example the Koreans, you got to have strict rules and lay down the discipline.
And in Singapore, they're building these great monuments, like these kind of statues and these futuristic monuments. One of them is called Arcadis Gardens by the Bay. And in America, like, you basically, the only place you might see something like this is if you go to Las Vegas. But I mean, that's being done purely for like gambling tourism. In Singapore, they built this kind of stuff just for the benefit of society, as opposed to America, where it has to be done for some kind of an economic niche, like gambling.
Yeah, I'm aware their main focus is economy, and having a small island that doesn't answer to the laws of nearby countries gives you a huge arbitrage opportunity. I guess it's in the same league as Vegas, the United States, Macau and China, or Dubai.
I think we did talk about population density earlier and whether it can work or not, because a lot of people say that it's inherently bad. I think it can work, but you need the right situation.
You
need to have people who have shared common goals for density to work.
Or strict discipline. I seems like Lee Kuan Yew found a formula that works.
Oh, I see this one of Singapore. It's like a water park being built over a freeway. That's interesting.
That's cool. Yeah, that's a very famous destination, Robert. Some of the wealthy go there and look over Singapore, and it's like, you know, you might find these, like, athletes or, like, celebrities or models just, like, hanging out with their, like, wealthy...
That's their boardwalk?
Yeah, it's a very famous attraction I know about Singapore, too.
I think it would be interesting to see a lot of these kind of independent city states like Singapore being carved out of the United States.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would love to see that.
The only thing is, in America's major metropolises, you don't really have that same sense of shared goals and values.
No, I think that's, like I was saying, that's the problem with political secession anymore in the modern West. People don't have deep enough roots for that, which is why I think there will be a different type of social structure. I tentatively call it neo-tribalism.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, there's different forms of it. I went through a phase where I was interested in national anarchism, but I think the problem with national anarchism is if you have one group that's living this kind of a rural tribal lifestyle, then you have another group that has a state power that puts them in a very strong sense of vulnerability. I think you do need state power. It's crucial to have access to state power.
Like, for example, California tried to secede. There's millions and millions of Californians who wouldn't agree with that. Or let's say you want a Mormon theocracy in Utah. Well, only like 60% of the state is Mormon, right?
Yeah, and in California's case, the elites sort of basically elected a new people. It's not a secessionist movement like the Quebec secessionist movement in Canada or the Southern secessionist movement that's based on like a long-standing tradition.
So I guess what I foresee is that it'll be less about geographical secession, but more, you might call it cultural secession.
And even within a place like California or even these megatropolises like LA in the Bay Area, you could see people forming their own kind of mini independent city states within those areas.
Yeah.
I mean, you already kind of do see that with these ethnic communities like Chinatowns.
Yes, yes. I mean, I was just looking at Singaporean culture. It's so different when you compare it to Japanese or Korean. It's this kind of, since there's more of this Western appreciation. As I was talking about, you know, the party girls.
Are you gonna say what? Are you gonna say the word?
And yes, I'm going to say the word. Basically, the point is that these party girls go after, you know, white men. They have much more appreciation for white men. It's going to most likely those white men are going to stay in Singapore and do business and have, you know, half white, half Asian children. We actually joke around with the term Asian Aryan, as this is. Maybe Singapore could be a more open-minded.
The term I've heard is Hapa.
Yeah, yeah. Like maybe the Singapore would be a more Western acceptable place for white and Asian or Eurasian, half white, half Singaporean offspring to happen. You know, compared to Japan.
They already have a foundation provided by the British.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think Hong Kong could have had that if they remained an independent city state, which would have made more sense than being submerged into mainland China. That's the other thing about Singapore is Singapore is very low in the corruption index, while mainland China is very high. And basically, they're the same ethnic group, so there is something, but there is something fundamentally different about the cultures of those two places.
Part of what's different there is the draconian penalties if you're caught. And as we discussed, the mercantile Chinese across Southeast Asia are a bit different and from different ethnic groups than the regular Han. I'm not sure what impact that has.
What traits do you see of a country's kind of being founded by a mercantile people? I mean, you could look at a country like Israel. That was founded by a a mercantile group that wanted to start a country from scratch. You see some parallels between Israel and Singapore.
I think you can look at a lot of examples in the region. For example, the Maronite Christians just north of there in Lebanon. Lebanon was a pretty stable, prosperous place by Middle East standards until the Maronites got kicked out. Or the Syrian Alawites also are the type to become billionaires when they start living in North and South America. And indeed, they seem to have kept Syria stable until recently.
So all those three countries, I mean, what do you see as kind of the future of those countries? So Syria has the Alawite elite, which is a Bashar Assad. Lebanon has the Maronite elite, which...
It had.
They're still there, but their influence...
They're still there, behind, but they lost the war.
They've traditionally been a mercantile elite. And then in the case of Israel, I mean, there's a lot of ethnic divisions, obviously, not just with the Palestinian issue, but within Israelis themselves.
Yeah, there was a bit of a Maronite exodus, and perhaps you've heard of people like Carlos Slim or Shakira.
Oh, yeah.
All exodus Maronites.
Yeah, I think Carlos Slim, we were talking on the last show, I think at one point he was the wealthiest man in the world.
Not surprising. Yeah, he owns their whole telecom industry and has a big holder in the New York Times, right?
What do you see as the future of those nations?
Of which nations? Back in the Middle East or the North America?
Oh, in the Middle East, like Syria, Israel, and Lebanon.
Lebanon basically was already taken over. There was some conquest of the cradle involved. Now you have this, I don't know. I know the situations of those countries are complex. I'm aware that one group that seems dominant are the Shiite Hezbollah in the south of the country, at least. But the place has been a lot more chaotic ever since the mercantile peoples were driven out of power, which is one reason why, as soon as the rebellion broke out in Syria, I was really hoping that the Alawites under Assad would prevail. Because it would just have been another Lebanon had they won. So if Syria... I could see the Alawites holding on to the coastal region and the big cities and either de facto or officially letting the Sunnis kind of do their own thing in the rest of the country.
I think it would be a very successful country if it were to secede. I don't know what's going to happen now. It seems right now there's kind of a stalemate in the Syrian civil war where Assad is staying in power, but he's still vulnerable in the long term, and there's a lot of different trends going on.
From what I could see, most of the country's money and economy is in the cities and the economically important coastal zone, and those areas also happen to be the main homelands for the Syrian Alawites and Christians. If they can hold Aleppo and Damascus and everything in between, I think they're golden.
You've written about Trump's foreign policy towards Iran. Do you see Iran and secular Arab nationalism as a counterbalance to radical Islam and especially Wahhabism?
They could have been in an alternate history. I think al-Assad is actually pretty much the last of the old Arab nationalists, or at least his father was. Saddam Hussein, as much as we vilify him, had a lot of secular influences in his rule because he was inspired by the Ba'athists and Arab nationalists who took their example from Nasser in Egypt. So I think they actually maybe could have reasoned with him by sticking with him as an ally and using him against the Iranians and continuing to play them off against each other. If they really wanted to back the Sunnis versus Shia. They had the opportunity. All they had to do was give Saddam some more money and guns and maybe even let him occupy Kuwait.
If we didn't intervene in the Gulf War, most of the funding for terrorism is from the Gulf states. It would have made a lot more sense to allow Saddam to annex Kuwait.
The pattern I see is the West freaked the hell out when Nasser came to power and started Arab nationalism. The British and French panicked to the point where they invaded the canal, and then the U.S. Panicked and stopped them, and they never did like the Arab nationalists because they never wanted to see a stable power in the Middle East area, a strong, stable power. The trouble is they tried so hard at it, they actually got their wish. Not only is there not a stable power, there's chaos, and radical Islam has taken over. So maybe what they should have done was figure out a stable order and get along with the Arab nationalists back when they had the chance.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, it would make sense, and there's still a lot of different special interests pushing against that. But, I mean, I think right now it's probably those Arab secular nationalists they're pretty diminished.
That's a movement of the 50s to 1960s, and Saddam was one of the last major players in that vein, and the younger al-Assad is the last remnant, as far as I know.
Well, you were saying about these different kind of mercantile groups that you were talking about, including like the overseas Chinese, there's a specific group called the Hakka, there's the groups like Armenians, Alawites in Syria, Maronites from Lebanon, and Jews. Yes,
The Armenians are also a mercantile people. They were the mercantile group for the Ottomans.
I know some people in the sort of like dissident populist right have a negative view towards mercantile diasporas because they view them as like rootless cosmopolitans who run around like plundering countries. They have this negative view. Are there positive attributes of mercantile groups that you can make for society?
I actually see the mercantile diasporas as a godsend if you are big into the HBD sphere, the human biodiversity, because it's like a repeated scientific experiment. What happens if you burn down their houses, take away all their stuff, and then send them somewhere else without a penny to their name, and then see what happens? It seems that the nature of a people matter most, because even if you take away everything they've got, they can go somewhere else and do well there too. Just a generation or two spent starting up. Like Armenians have done great for themselves in California and in South America. All the Maronites in Mexico and Colombia have cleaned up shop. And of course, everyone's favorite example, the Jews.
Oh yeah, you did write an article. I saw that where you criticizing anti-Semitism.
I mean, obviously the Jews do play a huge role in finance, Hollywood, the media, government. That's all true, but I think to blame everything on the Jews is excessive. Like, they've only been the huge power they are in Western culture for what, maybe the last 100 years. And it seems to me, if we look back to the 19th century, there was no shortage of psychopathic captains of industry and robber barons who had no qualms about exploiting people.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the thing. And then there's always going to be some other group that can move in and take power. Maybe in 50 years, Wall Street will be run by South Asians.
Exactly. I think the Jews are smart and they have good teamwork, but it's tough to stay on top. I think people like to portray them as being almost omniscient or invincible, when that's just not the case. I mean, they got pwned in the Russian Revolution.
You've written about how society should be ruled, and I mean, who should rule. do you think a society should be ruled by a mercantile class? Or do you advocate, what kind of a hierarchy of power do you advocate?
It's an interesting question because just looking at the present, completely out of touch, upper middle class that lives in major coastal cities. And by all accounts, they ought to have been decent rulers, right? They have pretty high IQ. They're skilled and conscientious people with good intentions. Yet look at the disaster that came about it. It's like you almost need a different metric for selecting a ruling class. You have to have the right amount of brains and common sense and training in all and how all the different segments of society live and how they interact. And how
you do need
things like ethnicity and IQ matter in managing a population.
Yeah, you do need some sort of a vetting process to select like the right traits for a ruling class.
Yeah, we are talking about this as if the upper class is completely decadent. They don't care, and most of them, it's weird because I think the upper middle class is all about meritocracy and getting college education and basically being quote unquote overeducated. While the upper class, they could be sitting on millions in trust funds, and they say, "Who cares about college? I could just shake hands with this guy or director and star in a movie." And basically, all the actors and musicians are this upper class people, right? And the upper class struggles to pretend as if there's a true aristocrat when really they're being duped to basically be exploited by the upper class. You know, this kind of thing that's happening.
I think you did make a point in one of your articles that you said the ideal situation would be like a high IQ society combined with socialism. Forget where you wrote that.
I called that article Smart Socialism. That was a while back. That, in fact, you do want shared services and safety nets so that productive people don't have to worry about how they're going to pay for a doctor and they can turn their efforts to better stuff. But you might have to take some almost Singaporean measures to prevent abuse of those safety nets and make sure that the most productive people are getting the best access to them. Where if you wanted to be really logical about it, you know, make sure that no one is like starving or dying on the streets, but give the best to your best people instead of trying to treat everyone as equal.
And that's going to be opposed by both liberals and conservatives because conservatives will oppose any form of socialism or a quote-unquote handout. But liberals will oppose it on grounds that it's anti-egalitarianism. But, I mean, it does make it's what makes the most sense.
I recognize that makes my views somewhat unusual in my section of the internet.
I agree with that because I think the key problem in our society is that the underclass has too large of a population size, but that we have a parasitic elite that controls too much of the wealth. I mean, that's the real dichotomy, and very few people are talking about that.
We were talking earlier about how suburbanization in America is fueled by people not having freedom of association in a vastly multi-ethnic, multicultural empire. All those forces combined is a disaster. There has to manage people, a wide variety of people in a high density like that, you have to differentiate what resources go where, to whom, and why.
You wrote this article, The Human Life Bubble. Can you talk more about that?
A lot of it is the similar principle that you have to pick and choose and prioritize. You can't have it all. For instance, I believe one of the major failings of our present culture is it puts all the priority on preparing for retirement. In fact, sacrificing all the decades you have when you can do things to impact the world in a positive way when you still have your youth, to prepare for the last 10 or 20 years of debility.
And you also talk about the backwardness of consumerism. I mean, you make a number of different points. One of the points that you make is that a lot of critics of immigration fail to realize that that's a natural result of their ideology.
When your highest principle is just making money, and nobody cares how it's done, even if it destroys the country in the long run. What is it Keynes said? In the long run, we're all dead.
Yeah, that's weird because it's like we're in a situation now where it's basically like, I have this feeling where the past three generations in America has basically been playing hot potato, right? Where it's like, I'm dead now, so this doesn't really matter. Hot potato you. And then that Gen X lives out their life. Oh, we're going to die. Hot potato you to the millennials. And then everyone is pretty much leading this like fatalist, hedonistic or nihilistic kind of lifestyle. And they don't really, they just say a bunch of things. They're happy to get them. And then they die. And it's very selfish. And it's not thinking about, it takes responsibilities and duties to be really an adult about things. And I think it's definitely like, you can't, seems like everyone, you can't just, you know, by the age of late 20, therefore you're an adult. It has to be like earned or something. There has to be this classical meritocracy, but it seems like that's not kind of possible with what we have today, you know, or a people existentialism or some existence that you know you're going
as
to
you
die.
Say, as you say, it's been about three full generations now since there was any solid notion of a socially shared purpose.
Mm. I'm counting the baby boomers
and it shows,
and the Gen X and millennials.
What's going to happen with?
I can see the mantle of leadership actually skipping Xers and millennials entirely as lost generations. I actually have a decent amount of optimism about Gen Z.
Interesting.
So that's basically the people now in their teens.
Yeah.
I was going to basically say the same thing. I think what's going to happen is eventually in the future, people will kind of sort things out and society will be dramatically restructured. But I think you will see this kind of a lost generation.
Yeah, especially if
MGTOW. I say this as a first wave millennial, which I've heard called sometimes the Oregon Trail generation.
Interesting.
You know, right at the cutoff to Xer, I can still remember like record players and cassette tapes as a kid, and
yeah, dial-up. I remember cassette
the advent
tapes.
Of dial-up internet.
Yeah.
Which is, I find talking to the more recent millennials, they barely know those technologies even existed.
Yeah,
it can't comprehend how different the world was. Where the Oregon Trail generation just got a glimpse of it, but having come to that from that place in between Gen X and Millennial, right at the cutoff, I think perhaps both those generations are too far gone in the baby boomer whirlpool.
What do you think will happen to those lost generations, and why are you more optimistic towards Generation Z?
I'm a bit more optimistic about Gen Z because they've had access to tablets and smartphones basically since childhood. They've always gotten their information differently than the other generations have. And even the later millennials take a huge influence from the university and school, whereby Gen Z, enough people have seen people come out of school with useless degrees. It doesn't have the luster that it used to, and they're thinking more critically and asking questions about the three generations that came before them.
Yes. I mean, one thing I could say about millennials is that, especially in the teenage years of millennials, there was no hyper-internet. MySpace was growing when people were like 14 and 15, and it was this new thing, right? To be the normie popular kid, you had to have a MySpace. And all of a sudden, MySpace kicked out and was Facebook, right? Then Facebook came Twitter, and then Twitter became phone apps. And then in their mid-teens, like this Andy Nowicki promiscuous style, Huxley, Brave New World, everyone's, sexing, whatnot, what we have today. It's this strange thing among millennials where it's this, the high school archetype is still there, but it hasn't died, and yet it's being adapted to technology.
I was almost out of high school before high-speed internet was really becoming common, and the first video memes were out there. YouTube didn't even exist yet. Like, I remember the novelty of it the first time I saw All Your Bass.
Yes.
Or even, and that was a completely, felt completely new and extraordinary.
There was something called ytmnd.com. They didn't have memes, they had fads, right? Nigga stole my bike, right?
Flash videos.
One of your articles was saying that you see people using the internet to form like these new identities and cultures. That's already happening.
Yeah, and I guess part of it is having grown up with a cassette tapes perspective. I've seen how it's changed everything and how people associate, or how I came to blogging as kind of an isolated person originally, and managed to reach out in the world and grow a lot more because of my access to the internet. It's been a revolutionary in my own life. And I see that happening on a larger scale as well. I mean, I grew up in a world where if you have something that makes you dramatically different than the 100 or 200 people you're likely to meet regularly, it puts your ability to even function in society in question. Now look at Gen Z. That's a constraint that they will never have encountered. I mean, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, because they're all on their computers and they all get some sense of a utter different reality or something. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with our kids, but I don't know.
You made an interesting comment about Trump, and it's interesting to see what will happen with him and what his policies will be. Because he's talked a lot about things like deregulation of Wall Street and tax cuts for the rich, but you were referring primarily to his voters, and they said the Trump movement will start with people talking about immigration and borders, but then you see that as a transition to people talking about what is the purpose of wealth and production.
All right, what's going on with Trump right now is, if to go back to Dune and make an analogy about it, right now Trump is kind of like Duke Leto Atreides when he's just arrived on Arrakis. Like these two great houses, the Republicans and Democrats have invited him there to take over, but it's a trap. I guess what I'm saying is that the party establishment, the entire political establishment, hates Trump. And Trump is no fool. He knows that to have a snowball's chance in hell of surviving, he's got to keep his base happy with abundant red meat. And sure, he's also got his Goldman Sachs lackeys that he has to keep happy. And on his side, he has to keep the military happy. I noticed since the very early days of his campaign, he threw all kinds of red meat to the military and the cops. Being no fool, he knew he would need them to stay in power against the establishment. So if you look at where his incentives align, you can figure out pretty much what he will do to stay in power. You can always count on rulers to do that. And sure enough, now that he's in power, he's actually pursuing his campaign promises pretty aggressively because he does have a fire lit under his ass.
Right, you wrote this article, sci-fi inspired by World War One, and you do show these interesting pictures. Can you talk about that article? It relates to the other one.
World War One is a weird period, and I think it inspires a lot of science fiction, because it's a period that felt like science fiction in real life. In a few short years, the world went from the 19th century to hyper-modern. And it really has this weird, gut-disturbing feeling when you see pictures of cavalrymen wearing gas masks with guns in 19th century-looking or period-appropriate uniforms. like, and I think a lot of the archetypes used in Star Wars come from that, like the storm, some of the stormtroopers and the mounted tripod guns they have are straight out of World War One pictures. What about that
picture from Star Wars, the one of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco?
Oh, that was a shot of the Starfleet Academy.
Oh yeah.
Of course, when you have the pristine science fiction where everything is super clean and white and everyone wears a white jumpsuit, it always seems to be in San Francisco or Geneva, one of the two.
Yeah, definitely. You wrote this article, How to Turn the Educated Against Political Correctness. And the thing is, I mean, political correctness is a stupid ideology, but I think the reason the more well-educated people are politically correct is because they have more to lose by being politically incorrect, but a lot of them genuinely buy into it.
We were discussing how the American upper middle class has been well-intentioned and bright, but utterly out of touch. And instead of having a stupid ideology and then they don't go out in the world to have experience that contradicts it, they need to have an effective ruling class. They have to have the right information and should go out and have some experience as well and not spend their whole lives cocooned in an office culture.
And then your article, Discrimination is Just, you actually do go back to reference Singapore. And then you have another article called Why Nepotism is Not Necessarily a Bad Thing. Because a lot of people always complain about nepotism.
The bent of the article with the discrimination is just is pretty simple. That if a certain, that you just lock up who commits crime, and if members of a particular group that commit crime more often and get locked up disproportionately, so be it. That's the main concept there. And the other article you... What was the other one?
Why nepotism... It's about nepotism. Why nepotism isn't inherently a bad thing.
That people will always help out people that from their in groups. In general, people help out people they think will help them and work against people they think won't benefit them. To ask people to behave any differently is to ask them not to be human. That's what I think about that. And one of the dysfunctions of America that we brought up a couple of times now is certain groups don't easily have freedom of association, so they have to take extreme measures to isolate themselves.
So the problem is not, I mean, nepotism is not a bad thing. It's perfectly natural. The problem is that the generic sort of like middle class white culture is so atomized. Then we have the nepotism of the elites, and then the nepotism of like the new immigrant groups coming in, and that puts the middle class at a big disadvantage. But the problem is this whole sort of nepotism is just something that's kind of been around throughout history. So I think middle class people need to kind of emulate. You're saying they need to kind of emulate those attributes.
If you try to banish nepotism, you just create a power vacuum that someone else is going to take advantage of it. Perhaps discouraging nepotism among European Americans, otherwise known as whites, registered a trademark, is that's part of what made it easy for Jews who had teamwork and worked together to step in and take advantage of that. Or for every other minority grievance group to get their share of pork barrel, which benefited these groups in the short term, but has proved unsustainable.
Before the election, you did write an article about Trump, and you said sort of the key principles that were affecting the last election were free trade, open borders, trickle-down economics, financial regulation, anti-union, low wages, a runaway military spending, and a paranoid focus on singling out evil nations, ideologically motivated foreign intervention, and you name those as like the main culprits. And Trump, obviously, I mean, he hasn't tackled all those issues, but he's tackled them more than any other major candidate.
Yeah, more than any other. We'll see about the trickle down part.
Yeah, of course.
That may might have to tick that one off the list. I think the single most important overriding principle is a return to pragmatism. Because what guys like Carter and Reagan even have in common and share is their idealism, where idealism comes first in their policy, foreign and domestic. I see Trump actually as the first post-Watergate president. Because look at Nixon, he was a Machiavellian pragmatist. And everyone since him has been an idealist in the style of Carter or Reagan. So that's why I call Trump the first post-Reagan president.
Yeah, because Trump is a Machiavellian pragmatist.
Yeah, he's more like Nixon in that respect.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to do what it takes to be popular and stay in power. And maybe when people say Trump has this authoritarian personality type, I mean, I can't say that I disagree with that, but he does want to be liked and supported by the people, so he is going to make concessions to the working and middle classes as opposed to past presidents who just sort of cater to their own special interests and think tanks.
It's ironic that the party establishments can't figure out that their hostility guarantees Trump will deliver on his campaign promises, because he has to stay in power.
Well, you wrote this article, The Future of Alt-Right Populism, and the thing about the alt-right movement, I think it's done some remarkable things, like break down political correctness, expand the Overton window. But by itself, I think it is a narrow and limited group. It has to transcend beyond that, and I think it has to appeal to other demographics beyond its core constituency. And you mentioned one of them. You talk about building a kind of broader political coalition that goes beyond the alt-right.
If there's a weakness of the alt-right, is that it's basically limited to the white working class. And I think you could make a more complete populist platform if you also included middle and upper, like more like upper middle class interests, like college loan forgiveness. Or actually, Trump already had a great start on that by knocking down the TPP, which was a huge issue for Bernie voters. I think he and his political successors could basically become the new American politics if they could take those two sides and join them together in one platform.
Yeah, you need to kind of build the right political platform to build a new coalition. I mean, it is difficult to do within the existing two-party systems, but I think it has to be done in the future. So basically, you can appeal to working class whites on issues like immigration, trade, and also preserving a social safety net. Then the issue of the college loan forgiveness can appeal to a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters. I think things like, things like environmentalism and being more pro-science can appeal more to the well-educated SWPL types. So you need to kind of take these different holistic approach to these issues to build a broader political coalition. Trump is making a major step in the right direction, but I think it's crucial to go further.
He has to keep in that direction, and I think he can do it, especially with the way the Democratic Party is managing its affairs. Basically, they're already, those who call it, think of themselves as ideological progressives, are already furious that the election was stolen from Bernie Sanders, and they just got another kick in the face that their guy Keith Ellison didn't get the nomination for chairman. and an establishment guy who was in Obama's cabinet now heads the party instead. That'll just end up driving more frustrated progressives gradually to becoming populists.
You do have an article where you called What I Believe, where you summarize your political ideology. Can you briefly kind of summarize that article?
In a nutshell, and what sets me apart, I mean, like Bernie Sanders caucuses, he's an independent that caucuses with Democrats. I'm sort of my own thing, but I guess, I caucus with the neo-reactionaries a lot because we try to solve a lot of the same issues, or the people that want to bring back monarchs or social conventions of previous ages exactly as they were. I want to take inspiration from what worked before, but I accept that never before in history has anyone flawlessly rewound the tape, that we have to create a new system that works with the unique stressors of modern technology on social and economic systems.
Yeah, I mean, I identify with that. I sort of caucus with the alt-right, but I view myself as independent. And we kind of need to get beyond these orthodoxies of both the left and the right and come up with ideas, and not so much about ideology, but about what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I see. I think it's a big deal that we recognize the same problems, and I hold a lot of those writers in high esteem and enjoy their work. But a lot of their tendencies are libertarian, where I sort of lean towards this hybrid authoritarian smart socialism. And I don't think we're bringing back kings exactly. Because reading about World War I, I see how the aristocracy completely melted down, faced with a novel challenge. There'd have to be something more flexible to rapid change.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Giovanni Donato for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thanks for having me back.
And also, thanks, Pilater.
It's been a great show.
All right, thank you, guys.